And I talked to my buddy the other day. I was like, "Hey, how's the operations been going?" He goes, "Oh my gosh, like the literal basement was just flooded with feces, and we had to
Oh.
go down and rescue the drones." And he says we're like taking buckets and like playing the floor as lava, except the floor was poop, and you know, like trying to go through and like pick.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Space Tomatoes podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Havoc.
I'm the other guy, LX. Not a Fed, promise.
Also not a Fed.
We all have three. All three have something in common, at least now. Today we're joined by a guest, Eric Robinson, a recently retired Federal Bureau of Investigation agent who left his role as a pastor after 12 years to become an FBI agent. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks for having me there, guys. Used to be a Fed, no longer a Fed. Friends with Feds, though.
Yeah.
No, you wouldn't have to tell us if we asked anyway, right?
Actually, there are rules about that. So depending on, I mean, this is absolutely not something I expected that we would talk about, but we have rules within our our manual of when you can and can't hide your role as an FBI agent, which is interesting. I didn't think I'd be asked that.
Wow. I guess I just thought that they could lie as much as they wanted to.
It depends on the circumstances and what your role is. Yeah.
All right.
So I guess, you know, my first question, the obvious one, right? How do you
look so young at this age?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. How do you look so young when you're now? How do you go from, you know, over a decade, was it 12 years as a pastor? And then what is the impetus that says I want to be, you know, an FBI agent and transition from, you know, a pastoral role into that role?
Yeah, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and I thought I'd be doing this for another 50 years because you can preach when you're 80 years old. That's fine. It's not heavy lifting. But the issue that I had as we were in Western New York, and along with a core group of Christians, we had planted a church that was meant to be one for outreach. So I told these folks, if you want to be a part of this, we're going to make mistakes on the side of showing too much grace to people, of being non-judgmental. So if people come, you got to be able to accept them if they're not wearing church clothes. If they've got weird tattoos or piercings, you know, what if they smell like alcohol? Like, we need to make sure that people coming in don't feel judged. And we did really well. And we were bringing in folks who hadn't been to church before and didn't grow up in that life. However, one of the issues with that is people who don't grow up in church sometimes have life problems. And so they brought their life problems with them. And I found myself not capable of separating my life from theirs, where when they brought me burdens, I held on to those things. So because of that, for two straight years, every single day, I had stress-related headaches. So wake up in the morning and I knew it was going to come, and here comes a headache. So there just came a point where I had to find something else to do. Even though we were successful, even though I was doing what I really enjoyed, I couldn't do it anymore. So I told my wife, I need to find a job with less stress. And so I joined the FBI.
So forgive me if this is a little more personal, and I certainly don't want to, you know, break any of those bonds. I feel that those need to be respected, but was this more of a testimonial, confessional type of a thing that was causing the problem, or?
No, it was, I mean, in some cases, but it was just people saying, I've got, you know, my wife's cheating on me, and you know, my kid might be developing a drug problem. We had one of our worship leaders, and this guy was a good friend of mine. He had a mental breakdown and then started going online and met another woman and left his wife. And, you know, that was a burden to me because this is someone I cared about. Whereas in law enforcement, there's plenty of times things don't go the way I want them to. And ultimately, I don't care that much. Bad guys get away. Okay. And, you know, that'll happen. And it didn't affect me in the same way that these people that I should care about then affected me long term.
Yeah, it's always been a struggle. I think it's a struggle for a lot of people. It's interesting to hear this as being a struggle from someone that was in a pastoral role. Is you know, a lot of people. A lot of people get turned off from the church, whatever sure. that may be for them, not because of the teachings, not because of the you know, the leadership at the church, but because of the other people at church. And that's always been something that I always kind of, you know, had to struggle with myself. And I'm also one of those, you know, walk in t-shirts and jeans and, right. you know, I figure, if the good Lord can make his disciples to wear sackcloth, I'm certainly no better than one of them. So, you know, if that's an acceptable form of garb, then I think I'm okay.
Yeah. This was a Baptist church as well. And so the one that we had been planted off of was the kind where, if you didn't wear a tie, you should be explaining why you're not wearing a tie because Jesus wants you in a suit and tie. And there's some of those silly add-ons that are there. Like, I remember playing Uno with some of the kids in the youth group and, you know, the old ladies coming by. So, oh, I never thought I'd see people playing cards at a church function. I'm like, it's not strip Uno. Like, it's not like whenever you color, you know, you reverse to red, you have to take a drink. It's a simple game.
Yeah, as someone that lives in the South, Southern Baptist is quite interesting. Even if you point to the fact that, you know, there are definitive verses in Scripture that, you know, basically admonish peacocking, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dressing up in gold and jewelry and all of that stuff is not considered. But anyway, so you're writing a book about your experience in the FBI. I guess my first question on that I like to ask authors is, you know, was this difficult for you, or is this just something that is flowing or has flowed for you? What's that process look like for you?
Flowing. What I did was to write about some of the cases that I was a part of, investigations, whether I initiated them or I played a role in them. And just like it happens with FBI agents, I just got to hang out with some of my buddies. I'm 3 months retired, and the SWAT team is hosting tryouts, and so I got to go out and see them. And you know, immediately, people are telling stories. So whenever there's open time where you're waiting on a dope dealer to show up, or it's after an operation, a search warrant, people tell stories. And so this was natural. This is what folks do anyway. I was just writing it on the computer. And so, yeah, sitting down, I thought, oh, hey, let me tell the story about the time I did this. Oh, yeah, right. And then there was that time I did this. And, oh, the guy on our squad arrested. Oh, there was that one weekend where we had two cases culminate where we arrested two sets of mass shooters before they attacked people. You know, the two biggest cases on our squad, and they went back to back from one day to the next. So, just remembering so many of those occasions that for us was like, yeah, this is the case we did. This is, you know, a Tuesday. And yet I also know it's pretty cool. It's like you tell somebody that story and you take the time to go in depth and people think that's amazing. So most of my days, you know, in the FBI, tedious, doing garbage things, you know, having to take silly online classes for bloodborne pathogens or something. And then there's those, you know, occasions here and there. So if you just compress all that and say, hey, well, let me tell that story in a fascinating way and leave out all the times the computer went down, turns out it's pretty cool.
Interesting. Did you...
I probably watched too much TV because, it's all fun and games on there, I'm sure, in the movies.
Oh,
I'm sure it's much different in real life.
And we had fun and games. There's, you know, we plenty of jokes. There's time for being serious when the public's looking, and then there's plenty of other times where, you know, we're pulling pranks on each other and making light of each other. But yeah, my youngest likes to watch Criminal Minds, and so when she would put it on, she would say, "You get 5 complaints, and then you have to shut up." And I usually run out of those in the first couple of minutes.
I'm sure. Yeah, Hollywood doesn't always do a great job of really driving the reality of things home.
Well, even to the point where we watch it and like one of the guys has a revolver. I'm like, no FBI agent can. You're not allowed to have a revolver. So, okay.
All right. I had no idea on that one. I think regular law enforcement still can, but most don't.
Yeah, it depends on where you are. There's some places where, like, you have to bring your own gun because they don't have a budget.
Okay. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, for us, when I got in 2002, there were still a couple of agents in the Chicago division who had their revolvers, and it got to a point where the types of weapons that you could have was narrowed and narrowed. Until it came down to it's all Glock and just a couple of handguns because they just want to streamline what the gunsmiths have to work on. Like this gun, that gun, or that gun, and all Glock. And then just one type of rifle too now.
Oh, really?
Makes sense.
What, just out of curiosity, what rifle is that?
It's either a Colt or a Rock River AR-15.
Okay. Interesting.
Just makes it easy for the gunsmiths.
Did you add in any of the minutiae and doldrums into your book? I imagine there's about 10 seconds of adrenaline and about 7 hours, 59 minutes, and 50 seconds of paperwork and stuff.
Yes. That is... When I was working in Chicago, that was my first office. I'm getting adjusted to a new life in law enforcement, and my wife would often say, "Oh, let me know when you guys are successful and you arrest the guy. You know, I'm so worried that you're gonna be safe." I'm like, if I die by any means in Chicago, it's gonna be a car accident. And we're sitting on these dope dealers, and it would be, you know, like this is me sitting in my car, you know, turned like this because I'm looking down that way, you know, for 5 hours before anything moves with my back killing me or my neck hurting. And, you know, you try to switch and then you get on the radio and say, "Hey, can somebody else take the eye? Because I got to walk around a bit." And so somebody pulls into your spot. And then the guy leaves like at 5 p.m. finally. And all of a sudden the adrenaline goes straight up and you're chasing to catch up in a busy city.
So you don't use like the cable box van, so you all get comfy, cozy chairs and monitors and listening stuff. And
we have, but it's not often because we'll be sitting on a guy. We're probably tapped into his phone. And so whoever's sitting on the phone tap is going to have a radio and tell us what's being said. And then everybody else out on the street is now following in case he's going to meet up with a supplier or a buyer. And now we can videotape that connection. Maybe we'll have the local police knock down the guy after he buys from him, and then we can take the drugs from him and let him go, call it a rip, and then we can preserve the phone tap while these guys think there's just dirty cops involved. So yeah, a lot of nothing, and then all of a sudden very exciting.
So you said rip. I don't know if that's so, terminology or...
Yeah, so what we would often do is if we know that there's going to be a drug buy or sale going on, whether it's an informant or, you know, we know from the phone that this seller is going to go to this buyer, we would be set up then that once the sale gets done, we'd follow the drugs away in that vehicle. We'd have the police pull them over, and, you know, see if they're compliant. And then when they're stopped, they just take the drugs. We'll do a search, take the drugs. It's just, it's all police. It's not FBI. And then they take that away and they just say, you're free to go. And so the guy just thinks it's dirty cops. So now we have drug evidence that we'll charge these guys with later. We'll preserve the phone tap because they just think some dirty cop got lucky. They don't think somebody's listening to their phone, and that's why we know that happened. And now we have evidence of how their words on the phone about drug sales are true because we're holding a kilogram of cocaine in our hands.
That's a pretty big amount, I think.
I'm guessing the CIs, the informants, have quite a bit to do with catching some of these people.
Yeah.
How do you build a relationship with someone like that? Because I'm sure it's a lot of, do they come to you or you catch them on something and you kind of say, hey, if you help us out, we'll give you a deal? Or
yeah,
how does that work?
In this scenario, it's almost always we caught them. You know, it will be local police saying, hey, we got this guy. He says he's willing to work off his time and he can buy from his guy again. So some low level dude who will then buy from the next level up. Well, once we get a buy off of him, we'll be recording a phone call from that informant, that newly turned informant, to his supplier. And then when that guy talks, now we will often write what's known as a Title III, which is a wiretap. It's called Title III. It's from the, I forget what year it was, the Omnibus Crime Bill, but it was Title III from that. And so now we're going to go up on that phone because we have dirty talk on the phone of the supplier. So now we're hooked up to him. Now we're waiting for him to go after his supplier. And we'll take that all the way to the border, pass it on to El Paso or McAllen, Texas. And now they're up on the cartels.
Does it ever not work out well for these people that turn snitches?
I never saw guys getting killed because of that, because it's like anything else. If they think you're a snitch, they're just going to walk away. Hmm. And I would have that discussion with other informants, like, yeah, but what if they find out I'm a snitch? I'm like, dude's going to act really weird and say, I don't want drugs. Why would you think I have drugs? Because if they think you're the police, they know they're going to get hammered if they harm them.
Right. Hmm. Right.
That's interesting too. That kind of breaks down one of the Hollywood theories right there.
Not always.
Obviously, you get into the cartel territory, and that's a whole different ball game, right? Because then they keep you around if they think you're a snitch, and then they go round up your family, and you know now we're going to extract the confession from you.
Right. And so when we were working high volume drug sale dealers in Chicago, part of our administrative process is we had to connect them to a cartel. And often that was just like, you know, it was internal and it didn't matter legally. So we just like look at some phone connections and go, okay, that calls this guy who's connected to this cartel. So boom, Sinaloa, we'll call it Sinaloa. But we'd arrest these guys and we're like, oh, so like what cartel do you belong to? And guys like, I don't know. I buy from a guy named Charlie out of St. Louis who brings it in from a guy down in, you know, and who knows who he gets it from, but I know that Charlie always brings me my dope.
How many of the people that you've done interrogations on would you say were more open about that as opposed to completely blocked off and opposed and just shut it down?
So
give me a lawyer.
Yeah. So I'm almost, well, I can't say almost always. I'm very often would get past them wanting a lawyer because they, if you're being arrested, you want to make some sense of what's going on. And I would play that up. So once you're arrested, I'm going to treat you nice, but also I'll tell you that if you want an opportunity to understand what your situation is, there's going to have to be some talking back and forth. Well, in order for me to be able to do that with you, I need you to waive your rights. You can refuse to answer anything I ask you. That's fine. And, you know, I'm affirming this that, look, if you want to stop talking, you can stop talking. If you want to not answer my questions, I just ask you to not lie to me, but instead say I'd rather not answer that. But nobody do that, because once we're talking, it's rude to say that. And I mean, it just seems stupid. But, you know, here's a guy who's looking at prison time. But if you bring it to a situation where it seems like it's normal conversation, they don't want to be rude. And so naturally, they're going to keep talking, even though they shouldn't be telling you something. And even though I've told them, like, hey, you can stop whenever you want, you can not answer my questions. Most people want to gain some type of control over the situation. And I'm offering, like, look, man, the only way you're going to gain some sort of control is for you to answer some of my questions while I answer whatever you have too. And that's when I lay out the case and most of them start talking. But to straight answer your question, gang members in Chicago, yeah, those are the ones. They've had enough run-ins with the cops where it didn't matter. They're not, you know, they're not talking.
Hmm. Interesting.
I'm sure the more experienced ones know just to shut up and ask for a lawyer. And
well,
the newer guys probably have more of a chance of keeping their yaps going.
What's funny is, like, even the gang members would talk. They just had zero value. Like one guy, you know, I'm playing cuts from the phone tap we had where he's saying, like, yeah, can I get 4.5 of the white things? And he's like, well, which was ounces of crack. And he's like trying to explain to me, like, no, man, I wanted 4.5 of them white T-shirts that I was going to resell. I got what?
Half of one.
You want a half a T-shirt? I don't understand. Like Brian Bosworth cut off here, Maurice Claret, I guess, I don't know. So, you know, so they just waste your time and see what they can get out of you. But the worst one I ever had was we did this huge gang roundup in Chicago. And so I figure I pick up this guy, gang member named Dorian. And I remember his name very well. So I'm like, well, I'm going to start from the beginning. So I had a photograph blown up, and it was this, and it came from a pin camera from the informant. So it's just, you know, boom, I took that still shot. I go, let me start with this. And I slid it over him. Can you identify this guy? And he says, I don't know. And I go, well, it's you, obviously. And I said, like, over your shoulder, you can see the address of the building. It's like, it's 4425. And like, yeah, pull out a driver's license. Like you live at 4425, you know, 26th place. He's like, no, I don't. I'm like, it's right here. And I said, look, the guy in the picture is wearing a necklace that says Doe. And you're wearing that necklace right now. He goes, no, I ain't. And I'm like, okay. Well, I'm not getting anywhere with you then, I guess.
I've met people like that. They could just, they lie and they'll stick with it too until the end.
Well,
yeah, I'm sure you kind of get adept at picking out whether people are lying to you or not with experience.
Well, yeah. And what's nice is, like, when we're doing the post-arrest interrogation, we're just trying to seal it completely. So I have enough. We're not coming to arrest you unless I know I can win the case. But like, if you confess, then we're not even bothering with a trial. So now it's easy. But I had this discussion with a guy who was talking about polygraphs, and he was saying, like, oh, I don't think polygraphs work. And I said, well, they do to a degree, but it's like anything. Like, if I hook you up to a polygraph and I say, hey, man, when I ask you about do you know who killed your neighbor, and you said no, it seems like you're lying. And you could just go, okay, I don't care. I'm telling the truth. And then you can continue to lie to me. And then when we're done, you're like, all right, I don't know why people confess, but they do.
Interesting.
We had one guy.
I think some people think they're gonna talk their way out of it somehow.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the good polygraphers. I've got a buddy who is like they know how to use. That's a tool. This is something they know how to use in conjunction with their interrogation skills. And so, you know, I say I don't know why people do it, but I do, and I know how you can get people to there. And there's a story of a guy who came in to apply to be an FBI agent, and one of the questions to him was, is there anything that any way that you've broken the law, but it hasn't been found out? And he was like, I've downloaded child porn. It's on my computer. And I think I would just go, nope, I don't need this job that much. But they convinced him to, it's like, well, we're going to have to see that and confirm it. So you're going to need to bring it in. And the next day, like,
wow,
he's like, yeah, here you go. Like people think it's a confessional booth. They think, okay, so between you and me, yeah, I've downloaded a lot of child porn, but that once I tell you that now that's clean, right? Now I can go to heaven, you know?
Unbelievable.
So going back to kind of the crossover from your first career, I guess.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself having any, I guess, okay, so before that one, did you leave the church and give up on that aspect of your life, or is that still something that's alive and well with you?
I would say it's alive and well with me as I accept it. So I did not leave the church. In fact, I preached on Easter Sunday in 2002. That was the last time in my church. Then I was in Quantico, Virginia the next Sunday. And then the Sunday after that, I was preaching in Quantico, Virginia because they didn't have a chaplain and I was filling in for them. And then when we got to Chicago, I was part of a church plant there as well to help out. Had been going to church for years, but just circumstances in my life, I have readjusted my valuation of how my faith works and how the church works, which is fine to get into if you want, but it's not that exciting.
No, the reason I'm asking is going from that to the next question, right? Interrogation. No, I'm kidding. I would be a terrible interrogator, I think. But so it helps me with, do I want to ask this next question? But now I think I do. Is did you find yourself coming across moral conundrums, things where you're like, morally, I don't accept this as being okay, but I need to do it as part of my job role? And if so, how did you handle that? How did you make that, you know, acceptable and okay?
Well, I hope this is boring but reassuring, but I never did. Anything that we engaged with in the FBI was signed off, like so many checks up our own chain, but also ultimately signed off by a judge. And so the most intrusive things we could do would be, you know, search warrant at your home, where now the public knows, you know, all your neighbors know something's going on, or tapping your phone, which is highly intrusive. Like you think you're just talking freely but however we're listening. And that all felt fine because authorities had said, I agree, you have the right to do this. And along with that, the agents that I interacted with were ones who not only wanted to uphold the law, but would want to do things right. So there weren't cases that I came across where guys were saying, well, let's kind of push the envelope here as far as what's right and wrong and see what we can get done. We stayed within the limits of what is proper to do. So there are things that we might come across as an opportunity, but I would have talks with agents like, yeah, I just don't feel right doing that. I don't know that I want to push this case. And emblematic of that is I was working with a guy from a different division because my informant had connections to his subject. And so as this guy was talking to my informant, he says to him, and we're trying to get in on a kid who was likely to kill a lot of people. And my buddy says, hey, when you get in there, don't be pushing the issues. You let him drive it. Don't be trying to entrap him. Don't be trying to make a case for us. We want to know if he is going to be violent. We don't want to make him that guy. And I remember thinking, that's exactly what I would say. We want him to show us who he is, not for us to create a great headline of how we got another terrorist. We want to find out the honest truth of, is this someone who's a threat to safety? And I think that's the sign of us trying to do what is morally right too.
Okay. Yeah. I was thinking a lot smaller than that. Right. So, here's a simple one, right? Biblically being untruthful, even in the, aspect of just leaving out information, to make it seem like it might be something else, is biblically not thought of as okay. I don't know that there's any scripture that counters that, right? That says, oh, but in this circumstance, you can lie.
Yeah, if you're law enforcement, it's fine. And then the Lord saith, but if you're a cop.
Right. And so I guess I was thinking a lot smaller, right? Like, are you an FBI agent? No, of course not. And I guess morally for me, I think that would be something where it's like, I'm actively lying. I'm.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's not what I thought of. And I know I have lied to people in my job just because I must have, and it didn't stand out to me. However, I would not, as a practice, lie to the criminals, because we're allowed to. I can tell, as long as it's not manipulative in a way where I would threaten, like, you're going to get the electric chair for this, or we're going to take away your children if you don't confess. So that you can't do. But I can say things like, we have two witnesses who put you at the scene of the crime, things like that. I never did that. Because if I got caught doing it, it wasn't a moral reason. But if I got caught doing that, then I've blown the actual evidence that I have. So what? My case is good enough. I don't have to waste it on making things up. And I feel like all of that came through to a degree as authentic, that if I'm being honest, it's just easier to talk. I don't have to try to keep, that's your job as the criminal. That's your job to struggle trying to keep your story straight, because you're trying to remember which one is actually the right one. I don't want to have to do that. I want you to be under that pressure, whereas I'm just talking freely.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That would, yeah, it was an interesting one for me when I saw the original pitch. I was like, well, how does that work, right? I mean, I'm kind of okay with this now, and so for me, the moral conundrum comes up for me to kind of, grind through my own brain. How does that fit, in my, because we all like to do that, right? You personalize whatever it is you're thinking about and think about how would I be, or how would it be for me to be in this situation?
Yeah. I think when I've been asked that before, I was always thinking that people are like, are you okay with killing somebody? I'm like, well, I don't want to, but there are situations. But yeah, that's a good one about lying. And I can tell you, I do remember one time I did lie, and it was to a pedophile when he caught us trying to interview his girlfriend as a witness. And we told him we were there as insurance adjusters.
Nice.
But I'm gonna rationalize that in my head that we were protecting the girlfriend. So there we go.
You probably were. Yeah. So awesome. So on your book, is it primarily just a collection of stories? Is there kind of a, yes?
So I start out with the idea if you took the sense of what the whole book is, imagine if there is a crazy social scientist who goes to his colleagues and says, hey, I want to see what happens if we pulled this Baptist pastor out of church and we put him in the FBI. Oh, he's never had handled a gun before, too. That would be great, wouldn't it? And then somebody else pipes up, like, let's put him on the SWAT team eventually. And like, yeah, that's a good idea. And so there's just this spread of, like, this is – I'm just a guy. I'm just the unlikeliest feller who was in the FBI. You know, I'm pretty smart. I was pretty fit. But the idea of, like, really, a Baptist pastor? That's crazy. This is what I got to do. So, yeah, here's a story. I had sent you one of the chapters. Here's the story of when I got to interrogate a pastor who was involved in a ring of pastors that were sex trafficking a teenage girl. And, you know, how did that go? So in each chapter, it's this is the case I worked on. This is the case I was a part of. And then the thread through that of what happened. And then I finish up with what we often do in military or law enforcement is an after action review, which is considering, hey, what went well and why? How do we screw up? What do we need to change? And so even with each of those investigations or these stories, going back to look at it then from that lens of here's a guy who used to be a minister, and now I'm thinking of how'd that work out?
Very cool. So did you actually connect those two in the book? Like, you know,
I tried to have the idea of, you know, I begin with my story. So here's me. I'm a pastor. Here's some of the stuff. Here's what I went through. Here's some funny anecdotes. The first sermon I ever preached, I was in Jamestown, New York, in Western New York, and very conservative Baptist church. Very, very conservative, very old. And I was their first associate pastor. So senior pastor says, hey, I'm going to be away on this day. I need you to preach on this chapter. Well, pastor was going like chapter by chapter through the Bible. And he says, this is going to be the passage I want you to preach on because it's the one that falls on when I'm out. I go, okay. So I look at it and the passage is entitled, God gives the right of circumcision to Moses. And I'm like, fantastic. The first sermon I preach is on circumcision. So I go to my wife and I'm like, hey, I'm thinking of opening with a joke. Tell me if you think I should do this. I'm going to say, Pastor Cook asked me to speak about circumcision today. The message is kind of long, so I took a bit off the end. And my wife says, I don't think you should tell that joke. And so I didn't. But then I realized if I couldn't tell dick jokes in church, was I really free to be myself?
The great awakening.
Yeah, that's it. And that's when I realized I have to join the FBI instead.
we're Yeah, okay. So dick jokes.
Well, the dick jokes, yeah, they flow freely, yes.
How interesting is it when you have to or you had to investigate crimes like that in your former profession or even in the law enforcement? I'm sure there's corruption and you know that kind of activity. And that did you ever have to investigate any police corruption?
Yeah, I was illegal activities? I worked civil rights and public corruption in Chicago, and so one of the cases I had was actually a historic case. My buddy Jake owned the case, but I was number two on it. And it was investigating John Burge, who was a Chicago police commander, who had for decades, he and his team had tortured suspects to get confessions out of them. And I mean, it was historic. Like this is, I mean, it's not that big a deal. Like, there's books written about it. There's you can go on Wikipedia and look up John Burge.
Pretty big deal to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, a big deal in that, like, this was known in Chicago that here is a guy who almost exclusively, if not exclusively, the victims that he tortured were black men. And so this was a case that we were working 15 to 25 years after the fact. So we're long past the time where he had tortured them, and just 5 years prior to when we got a conviction, John Burge had stated in federal civil court while he's being sued by one of the victims that he knew nothing about torture in Area 2 of Chicago. And so, just like Elliot Ness, we got him on perjury and obstruction of justice. But we're interviewing these victims like many years later. They'd already served their sentence. they're already out, and they're telling stories about how they were tortured, how they're beaten to get a confession.
Do you ever get any?
It never quite seems like they get the justice that they deserve when they're public officials or police. It's usually like, oh, you have to resign and get your full pension and maybe move to a different agency. That seems to be the biggest consensus on that.
Well, and with John Burge, like, this was like he was already retired. He was an old man, so he got to live out his life. And I mean, in the end, he got, I think, maybe 4.5 years for 20 years of torture and abuse.
Mm.
It wasn't justice, but the Chicago PD had turned a blind eye. He was doing a great job, so they're going to just dismiss the rumors and the reports. And the friggin' FBI didn't do their job either until many years later.
So in circumstances like that, you know, one of the things that always pops up to my mind is, you know, leading in with what you kind of ended with there. How much pushback is, I imagine there's in certain cases where they look at that and they go, dude, if you do this, all these people are going to sue us. How much pushback do you get from above on cases like that? Hey, you know, be careful, or you better, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So there's a saying in the Bureau, big cases, big problems, small cases, small problems. And if you're going after a case that you know will make headlines, there's a lot of people eyeballing it. And there's folks who are going to, that are like people you haven't met before, you know, as an agent, are going to start getting involved and giving input. And most of what we do doesn't, like, here's a guy, I proved he's a criminal, we take him down, arrest him, no problem. And then there's a few like that where, you know, somebody from headquarters is debriefed on it, and then they start pushing back or directing, and that's just the worst thing. No agent wants that. That's their nightmare.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter who's like in the White House at the time or who the head of the FBI is and what cases get pushed at that time. I'm sure there's some kind of political aspect to that office. Because even in the local sheriff's office, it's a political aspect.
Well, it's more political in the local sheriff's office for sure. There's trickle down to the field to a degree. The great majority of what agents do is just like the same as always. Like, I can only work cases that my informants bring me, or, you know, bad guys that I see. I can't manufacture stuff. So as an example, during Black Lives Matter protests and such, Trump's first term, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, saying, hey, let's look at Antifa and see if they're trying to create violence or destruction of property. I said, okay, you know, let's see. And, you know, we're trying to find these guys, at least in our area, they're not there. You know, they're not talking about organizing. And so there can be like an emphasis or like a push for something. But again, like you can have guys saying, we want to wipe out Antifa. And then I'll come back with, yeah, my informants have nothing. Like, they're talking to these guys. Like, can't charge them if they don't break the law.
So more of like a general directional type of a push than like, you need to do this.
A flavor, you know, you know, somebody's putting like a pinky on the scale of saying, maybe a little more of this.
Yeah.
It's a little bit before your time, but how would something like Waco or Ruby Ridge get escalated to what happened in those situations? Is it just like one guy picks up like a tip or something and it just kind of moves from there? Or
yeah, I mean, obviously it's so much different now because, you know, we've got the internet, we've got the National Threat Operations Center where things come in. But the way that cases are made are, you know, whether an informant brings us something or we task him to look into a new group or a person to see if there's violence there. Call comes in from a neighbor who, you know, sees something. We might even get it from the newspaper where, you know, you see a deal being done and people talking about suspicious change of money. So we'll look into things, and then there's kind of different levels. There's a full investigation where, you know, we're going all in, and then there's kind of these assessments where we're going to look at it. We have limited legal authority, and we want to see if there is something here that we can now move up to another level.
Interesting.
So you want to know more, you can ask more, but that's the general way of things go.
I'm just thinking like, so like the FBI knocks at my door, Havoc store, what should we say? Like, meet feet? I'm not talking to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always say this, like, I read some Reddit comment where people are like, if the FBI ever shows up, you should say this. I'm like, whoa. If the FBI shows up, they're probably a criminal. Like, why are you telling guys, don't you want these people off the street? But I mean, obviously, if it were me, I know, and you guys can be smart enough too. Like, I know what to not say. And I just always tell people, just be polite. So if somebody asks me a question, I'm like, yeah, I don't want to answer that. Is there something else I can help you with? Because, I mean, hell, the guy might be there saying, yeah, I just wanted to let you know that there's a murderer on the loose and we're looking for him in the woods behind your house. Like, and then, you know, you come to the door and say, get the hell out of here. And you're like, okay, best of luck there, buddy.
Yeah. What was your favorite, as far as training goes, right? Physical training in the FBI. What was your favorite part? Like,
So we had SWAT training regularly, and being a part of that, like just doing it, close quarter battle training, CQB training, it's like learning line dancing where guys are going through and you've done this enough where one moves, two moves, three moves, four moves, five's at the door ready to move, you know, and this guy gets out of place, is exposed, and then that guy jumps in. And you look at it like, I mean, I kind of feel a little tingly. Like, we would go to like abandoned, we get permission, and we go to like abandoned hospital or school, and we'd do a cold run where we've never seen it. And we'd hit this complex room with so many danger areas, and boom, 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 we'd do that. And I just go, oh, that was cool. And being a part of it, then you appreciate it even more of like, oh, wow, we can solve this. And solving it in the tactical sense is everybody protecting the next guy and making people as safe as they can. So when I would teach tactics to other agents, one thing I regularly said is tactics is about being a buddy. So that if your buddy's in a place where he's exposed, hey, I'm going to be a buddy and I'm going to cover your back with my gun and plates so that you're safer. And now, if that exposes me, then this guy's going to be a buddy.
Something I've always wondered about, like the whole, you know, breaching, right? I obviously there are circumstances, right? You start talking about HRT, different concept, right? There's an immediate and urgent need that this has to happen, right? Otherwise you're potentially going to lose a lot of lives, right? Whereas in a lot of cases, I look at these and I go, look, I mean, right off the bat, CQB is well known as the most dangerous type of battle with the highest mortality rate. Because you're going into
a house.
You have a floor plan. You may have a floor plan. You may even have an outline of what it looks like in most of the house, but you could be coming in where there are multiple armed people with very high caliber weapons that, you know, I mean, you're stacking up in a hallway, right? Yep. because that's the only way to get to a door. And next thing you know, big rounds are coming your way. What is the, I mean, what is the reasoning behind some of this? I've always wondered, why not just camp out and wait for this person to be out at their mailbox, or wait for this person to be, you know, somewhere that's more isolated, a takedown in that manner, so that you're not, you know, risking the lives of the agents as well as, you know, potentially innocent people inside of a dwelling?
No, that's a good question. And that is often what we do. So even as a SWAT team, so if a subject hits a certain threshold on a matrix to say he's this dangerous, and so that might be criminal history, cameras, guns, what a number of things, maybe it's the terrain, then SWAT's going to get called. So they're the most dangerous guys, and we go because we've got better equipment, we've got more tools, and of course, as we talked about, more training, smoother and faster. And the first thing that we do, and the first thing that agents do, all agents, is we set up a tactical L where we've got all our fields of fire covered. We can call out anybody exiting, and then we announce our presence and try to have them come out to us where we're behind some type of ballistic barrier, you know, whether it's a vehicle or in a Bearcat, an armored Bearcat. And the people who know what they're doing look outside, see 15 guys with rifles and lasers on windows, and they realize I have one choice, and that is to give up. And so we may get a barricaded subject at times, but for the most part, and then we have ways to mitigate that. But guys, you know, we've had plenty of guys where we see them in the window and they're peering out, and then they come out and we get upstairs and we see a gun on the table next to that window where he's ready to go. He sees he's not going to make it. He's got one choice. So that is often what we do. We're trying to do that. And then we're also porting windows, sending in drones so that they can see, okay, here's an approach. Now we can breach where the breacher is going to be safer. It's less likely to catch fire. I was a breacher on our SWAT team, and I would often tell the guys, I'm the most important person on the team, because if I don't get that door open, we can't get the job done. And I'm also the least valuable, because here I am standing in front of a door with a ram in my hands with my side exposed, you know, for a couple seconds, hopefully.
Interesting. I guess, you know, story time. What would be and maybe you can't say, and that's okay as well, but what would be the worst breach and entry that you had, bar none? Like, how bad was it? And if you can't talk about it, that's acceptable.
No, we could talk about it. I was a young breacher, and we hit the front door, and it took me probably 8 swings because the front door is where they put the couch. And I'm like, that's pretty impressive. Like 8 swings, and I breached the door and moved the couch. You know, so I remember, like, I'm probably 5 swings in, and my team leader's like, hey, give it up, give it up. I'm like, nope, I can feel it, I'm getting there. So that was a rough one. I had one of my buddies, JB. Oh, dude, he hit, I think we're in Pittsburgh, and he hit the door and came back, and he was swinging so hard and fast, he hit his forearm against the door jamb, and he had like a knot like this, and it didn't break. It wasn't broken. It was just a massive muscle contusion, and he sat down and got a little pale, you know, after that.
Oh yeah.
And then I had a buddy in Cincinnati division who came up to breach a door, and also hit the door jamb like in his wrist. And so after he busted it, he came out and said, like, hey, I'm out. You know, I hit my wrist. And it wasn't until they took him into the ambulance that they realized he'd been shot. So as he was at the front door, guys didn't know it was the police, and, you know, popped around from the couch and then went, oh, and then hid the gun. And, you know, nobody's saying anything. They're not going to say anything either. But, yeah, very fortunate. He just got shot in the wrist, and that was it.
Wow. Have you ever had a circumstance where a perpetrator, I guess. Have you ever had an instance where after the fact, maybe years go by, they get out, et cetera, and you get a phone call from them thanking you for saving their life or anything like that?
I have not. They usually aren't going to try to look up the guys who put them away. I did have one guy we arrested for possession with intent to distribute cocaine. And I remember, like, he said, "Hey, who's got a flashlight? I'm going to show you how I have no nose left. Like, I'm going to stick it up there." And, like, "I believe you, buddy." And he thanked us. Like, he was a nice guy. And he said, "Hey, I just want to let you guys know I was not selling cocaine. I'm not fighting the charges," but he goes, "I used it all, you know," and it was a large amount. And his whole point was, like, "I used so much, I have no septum left." And he just goes, "This is going to be good for me." Like, that was his attitude. It was like, "Yep, this is the best thing that happened to me. I need this. I'm glad I'm going away." So that was remarkable. And I had one father thank me for executing a search warrant and arresting his son because he couldn't control him. And he was pretty sure. And the reason we were there is that his kid would be a mass shooter sometime. So he had hidden guns that his son had purchased because he was afraid he was going to kill people.
And now on the flip side, do you ever worry about people that may not be as grateful for your services? And do you feel like it kind of, because you're out there a lot now doing all these podcasts and your name's out there. And do you ever worry about your family or anything like that? Like, anybody doing anything like that?
The kid I just mentioned. So that kid I mentioned, he goes away. He went away for a year. I mean, I just hit him with gun charges because he had been institutionalized against his will. So there's a box on the form. You got to check. And he lied. So put him away for a year. And as soon as he got out, I talked to he started like contacting me or like trying to harass me. Definitely not over the line. So like it wasn't threats, but you got the sense. I talked to his therapist, his counselor at the halfway house. And he goes, "I have worked with death row inmates for 20 years. I've never been as afraid of a subject as I have of this kid." Mm. And so because of him, every day when I parked my bureau vehicle, it was in a public garage in the building adjacent to where we worked, I would get out and the first thing I would do would be look around before, like, I'm turning my back and putting my head down because I figured he's going to pop out at some point.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot to live hanging over your head. That, to worry about that kind of stuff, though.
It was less of like it hanging over my head and worrying, and it was more of like, well, there's no point in being stupid. Like, let's give a look. Like, so I wasn't like, again, like compared to being a pastor, that didn't stress me. I mean, which is crazy because I wasn't going through anything that normal pastors don't deal with. I wasn't special and it wasn't extra hard. I just couldn't handle it. And here's a kid that I thought, maybe he'll kill me someday. I'm like, yeah, okay, I should look around first. And it didn't bother me.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I mean, like I know I'm pretty careful. I don't even put my name out there and I'm just some, you know, schmo doing the silly podcast. I'm nobody.
Yeah. So.
Well, I've never put anybody in jail for anything.
I kind of had to talk him into it, to be honest with you.
Ah, good.
He doesn't like podcasts.
So stay on that side. That's good. So for me, the one positive is, and I'm pretty sure I haven't Googled myself lately, but I would occasionally do that just to see if there's something that pops up, make sure people can't identify where I live or something. And I think the one thing that would come up if you put in Eric Robinson FBI was a time that a white kid, but a pimp in a cutoff shirt. He was one of the guys buying 4.5 shirts. Probably he bought the half. So he had a cutoff shirt and track pants. We had arrested him after this long operation. And he's like, oh, I can give you anybody. Like, I can do all these buys. And I'm like, look, man, I gave him my business card. I said, you come back Monday and you call me or we're just going to charge you. And you better have some real information. And then I totally forgot about him until one day the manager of a local sports chain, sports bar, came by and asked for me. And he goes, oh, so you're Eric Robinson. So what had happened is I gave the guy my business card, said, you call me. This kid and his girlfriend, prostitute, went down the street. This guy had balls this big to do this. Shows a business card and says, I'm Eric Robinson with the FBI. I got to debrief this informant. And he made off with like $85 in appetizers and drinks. And this dude thought that was an FBI agent. Like some 20-year-old kid in tracksuit. So I think that guy stealing my identity and the charges against him are about the only thing you'll find on me in the Google. I'll have to Google myself.
I mean, talking about appearances, I probably wouldn't have pegged you as an FBI agent if I didn't know. I'd say like construction foreman or maybe auto mechanic or lumberjack. I don't
there
know.
There we go.
Something. FBI agent probably would have been the last thing on my mind.
When
flannel.
Yeah. When I would do trainings for other police departments, or we would often do this large one for the Ohio Tactical Officers Association, and I'd give everybody one shot. I'd have this FBI patch, and I said, if you can guess what I used to do, I'll give you a patch before I got in the bureau. And by that time I'd had told a few dirty jokes and, you know, things like that. And, you know, it'd go around and I'd get lumberjack and, you know, guys are like, you're in the military. I'm like, why would that be unique? Like, what? Why would I go, I'll give you a patch if you can guess I was in the military. Like, that's stupid. But I did have a guy get it.
Wow. Nice.
I imagine it was a pretty interesting, like, I'm, again, in my head, I'm putting myself in this position. I walk into my first interview. They pull up my resume. And so you know you're at the FBI, right? Okay. And you're pastor?
Yeah.
I mean, how did that go? I got to imagine.
I have a feeling that it has a lot to do with personality and being able to be kind of a social chameleon, because you seem pretty affable and able to move in conversations with different people, or you wouldn't be doing these podcasts.
Well, I can, and I don't know. So I'll say this, you know, now in being able to converse with people, also being able to listen to them, which obviously I'm trying to do as a pastor, is very significant. So after the fact, I think it paid off. I don't know. Having been around applicant coordinators, I don't know if that's always in their forethought of their mind. But when I applied, keep this in mind, I applied in 2001. My application is in process. September comes around, and my background was studying to be a missionary to Muslims. So here's someone who has worked with Muslims, talked with them, understands the culture and religion, and then 9/11, and let's put this guy through. So at least that got me in the door. I take the first test, which is like an SAT type test, and I took it, and I remember going, well, I tried. And then they called me back. I'm like, I don't know if you scored the test right here. And then the next parts were written and verbal, like an interview where you've got to tell a time where you had to overcome something, you know, what were the results, what did you do? And at that point I knew, okay, I know how to talk. Now I feel comfortable, and you get the fit test, and I was in good shape at the time. So, after I got through those first couple, I'm like, okay, I think I can do this.
They do a polygraph and all that stuff too, right? That's part of it.
Yeah, and that was, my pants were soaked when I was done. Like, it's a lot of, it's rough. And this is where, this is great. On your podcast, I will now announce, I lied so much on the polygraph and I got past them. Guy was terrible.
Really? Does that mean you're a psychopath, or what does that mean? You're just a good liar.
Just a good liar. Just a good. No, I mean, it was rough, and I remember like being really stressed that I wasn't getting past until he came back with like, I'm having a lot of trouble on here with, are you working with another government? I'm like, okay. If that's the one we're having a hard time with, I'm gonna calm down, because I'm not.
Well, that's a good
or point. Are you?
Or am I? I don't have or to answer your question. I don't have to answer your question.
I don't answer questions.
Well, this is your opportunity to tell your side of the story, because if you don't tell your side of the story, we only have one side.
My gosh.
We have to make our decision to arrest you based on that.
You're so good. You're so good. Who taught you that?
Secret agent man.
My wife watches too many of those interrogation videos.
Yeah.
Which is bad for me, because she's a master of the Reed technique, and I have no escape. I can't lie to her.
So the rough
whatsoever.
So I don't. There's always aspects that work and don't work. I don't like the Reed technique, because part of that is shutting you down. So if you start you use ruses all the time, which I don't like. I don't like ruses and telling lies and like trying to see what works. And also, if you start telling me things I don't want to hear and go against my beliefs, then I shut you down and bring you back to no, answer my question the way I want you to. That's terrible. And so as a pastor, I did this. As an FBI agent, if you want to start telling me lies, I'm curious. I'm open, man. Tell me more. And there's a point where I'll stop you, but I want to hear your lies. Because if I hear your lies, then I know where you stand. You're not cooperating. And secondly, that's probably going to be your defense. Like when you start going through this. And how do I know I'm right? So if I tell you like, hey, LX, I know you killed your neighbor. We had people who saw you do it. And you say, I didn't kill him. And I start shutting you down and say, no, you killed him. We have people who. However, if I say we have people who saw you kill your neighbor, and you say, I didn't do it. Now I'm curious. And you go, he came at me with a rake and I tried to get away. And as he swung, I pushed him and he fell and hit a rock. And like, so now I'm hearing what might be the truth or a bigger story. So tell your wife to stop using the Reed technique.
You just I tell the truth, because it's much easier to.
Oh, to well, right. Well, just tell the truth. There's that too.
If you tell the truth, you ain't got to remember nothing.
It's real easy.
The truth shall set me free.
Amen.
Yep. Well, awesome. So, what would you say was the thing you least liked about being in the FBI? And you can't say paperwork. You can't say.
No,
paperwork.
I wasn't going to say paperwork. I will say this. Knowing that criminals are going to not be brought to justice. So I can have a case. Let me just say this. I had a case on a guy who was stealing money. So a white collar financial case, and his accountant helped him in it. His attorney helped move money around. His first business partner, the two of them took $9 million from investors back in 1997. And those three guys were not charged. Another attorney helped him put forward fake bond deals. He wasn't charged. That's the worst. So, you know, this guy got charged and four others got charged too. And that here's these guys that I know are criminals. I know they broke the law, and oopy doopy. I guess that's the way it goes. So that's the worst.
Do you ever have anybody try to bribe you and say, hey, you can Take this big stack of cash and make this disappear for me.
No, but you know what? I remember we'd have discussions about that because I would tell people like, I can't think of how much money it'd have to be because it'd have to be a lot. I don't want to live my life thinking, oh my gosh, what, you know, am I going to be found out? I'm a crook. Like, we're talking about millions. So if somebody had millions, I might be open to it. But, it's just so much to give up, like, for your integrity and just sense of well-being that I got to be able to just be set and walk away. So, no, never had that. But I did once with another agent we carried, I think it was like $560,000 in cash to the Federal Reserve that we had seized off a guy.
Wow. Did it feel like a lot of money?
It was a few duffel bags.
That's it was like all in 20s?
Well, like big ones. Yeah. Oh, it was big.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely a lot of money. Yeah, that's a lot of money. Oh, real lot of money. That's real money, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, in cash.
Did your friends from the IRS come looking for their cut?
So you're like, hey, we're going to take this $1.5 million to the Federal Reserve. And you get there and you're like, yeah, man, here, we got this $1 million. And can you put this $560,000 in the locker for us? Because we just got this $560,000. No?
560-ish. $540,000. So what's crazy is the guy who headed up our forfeiture unit in Chicago had so many bank complaints written about him because gang arrest, dope arrest, whatever, we'd seize the money and then hand it over to the Federal Reserve to be forfeited. And then, you know, there'd be like $1,000 of counterfeit money in there, but his name was on it. So they'd write a report like just – it was done administratively, not to actually file a complaint, but like, you know, it would say on this day, even though it would be, you know, might be me, but it was in this guy's name, so-and-so brought $1,000 worth of counterfeit funds to our bank and because they had to report it.
Wow.
Yeah. We're not even going to bring up the civil asset forfeiture thing. Cause I know that's probably a sore subject with some of our hosts here.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say this. These guys were all they were all pretty high-end dope dealers, so it wasn't – and I get where you're coming from. So this wasn't the guy who's like, you know, we pull you over, like, prove that you went to casino, and we're going to take this until you can. So, yeah, we didn't do that.
I saw one. The guy had – he had bank receipts for it all, and they still took it. He had to fight it for a couple of years and – court. Yeah. It just seems a bit unfair to me.
No, it is. It definitely is. No, we caught you on a phone tap selling dope, so definitely no. Yeah.
Right. That's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
Like the I guess it wasn't a bank, it was a private safety deposit company. I'm sure you heard about this. I think it was in California and the FBI raided it because they had suspicion that there were, you know, drugs and money laundering operations going on and you know, stuff like that. For me, that's what LX was referencing. Yeah. I'm kind of like, I don't think that's an okay thing, but you know, hey, circumstantially it depends on the circumstance. Right. But unfortunately at times our laws are written with blanket statements that don't make a distinction between what is a legitimate, you know, real reason for doing something and what isn't, right? So
yeah,
it's unfortunate, but
it's like anything else. It's like the guns. Like, you can put a gun, it's a tool. The polygraph's a tool. You put it in the hands of people who are going to abuse it and there'll be problems. You put these laws in the hands of people who might abuse it and there's problems.
Absolutely. Yep.
I know you're talking about the polygraph. Do you have anything to do with the voice stress analysis stuff? Did they use that?
No. They use the different conductance. And honestly, it's like it's really just to give that extra edge. It's much like the difference between a general agent and a SWAT guy. Well, the SWAT guy has a lot more training and better tools. So the difference between me as an agent and a polygrapher is he's doing the same thing I'm doing. He's just like better trained and has more tools. And so the polygraph is one of those tools to try to get you to do what he wants. Much like in SWAT, I got cut saws, chainsaws, battering rams, rifles. That helps me to get you to do what I want too.
Explosive breaches.
We don't do those.
Really?
Yeah.
You get to play with the flashbangs at least?
Oh, those yeah.
Those are probably fun, huh?
Flashbangs are great. I would take them when I would talk to classrooms, junior high, high school. I'd hold up a flashbang. I said, this is a flashbang. It does two things. Who can tell me what those two things are? And then you'd have a kid going, flash and bang? I'm like, yeah, that's right.
That's it. Nice.
Blind and disoriented. I do have a question that I just thought of. Are all FBI agents special agents, or is that just for special? So everybody's a special agent.
Everybody's a special agent. And then we have about half the population of the FBI is the professional staff or support staff that are not gun toters, that play all sorts of roles everywhere from secretary to automotive and different types of analysts and administrative folks.
And I've just lost the terminology, but there's an SSA as well, right? And
supervisory special agent. Yeah, so that'd be my first level boss, the one who runs the squad.
Super special agent.
That's right. And then we have the special agent in charge, who's the guy who looks over the whole division.
Pretty cool. Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
But the place you want to be is the special agent, because now you're out doing stuff. You start getting up in administration, you start getting up in management, and you don't have the fun anymore. A little more pay, a little less fun.
Just more management paper. Yeah. Lots more paper, I imagine. Although, I would imagine it's
digital paper. Digital paper.
Yeah. I would hope so by this time, right? But you never know.
Well, until 2012, we were using a DOS-based computer program.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. No issues there.
you'd have to like shift F5 to go to the next page.
Oh,
boy. It was crazy.
Well, you know, hey. Well, welcome to the current century.
Since then, it's been a very good technological advancement. So, long time and then quickly.
Very cool.
I want to know the important things, like a Crown Vic or a Tahoe. Which is your?
I've had both. I've had both. The last vehicle I had was a Tahoe. Ooh, so good. I love that vehicle. And then the one before that was a Tahoe. I hydroplaned at about 2 a.m. going to a SWAT op, crashed it, got out, pulled over and looked and went, okay, this is still drivable. And went on down the road. And I told a buddy this. He goes, son of a bitch, that's why I love your generation. You get in an accident, bust up your vehicle, and you're like, well, I got an op to get to. But then I got like 15 minutes down the road, and I went, I don't know if my head's injured. I need to go home. Like, you know, here I am. Who knows? And it was a good thing I did. Actually, I was fine. But everything I had was in a lockbox in the back, and it took me an hour and a half with a sledge and Halligan to get the hatch open 2 days later.
Oh, wow.
So there's no way I would have been able to go on the operation because wouldn't have had a gun.
You weren't exceeding the posted speed limit, were you?
No, it was just honestly, I was doing like 65. I mean, it was above the speed limit, but like I wasn't. It just, I've never had to just hit it and slam that wall.
Hmm. Wow.
So I love me a Tahoe.
Tahoe. I had to talk my wife out of getting one of those. Again, we live on a small farm.
Yeah. And,
you know, we have a lot of mud. A lot of mud. Yeah. And Tahoe, I'd just be towing her around all the time.
Well, I didn't have to pay for this, so.
Well, that's, yeah.
I don't think I ever would. They're pretty expensive.
And here's another question I've always wondered. what is the, there seems to be a rule, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but it seems to be a pretty hard, fast rule that you guys only drive American Motor Company cars.
That had been the hard and fast rule until a few years ago. So now it is almost all American-made vehicles. And I assume it's probably because half the foreign ones are made in America too and back and forth. So, yeah, that was always the case. And then maybe 5 years ago, we started getting like, oh, here's a Nissan and here's a Kia.
Who got stuck with the Kia? Like the new guy?
Not the SWAT guy, because we got all our crap to carry.
Like, hey, Joe, you get the Black Tahoe. Bill, you get the Black Tahoe. Hey, Fred, you get the Kia, man.
It wasn't a Sorento. It was, you know, at least a little bit bigger size. Or it wasn't a Kia. The Hyundai.
Same difference.
Yeah.
It's a little piece of junk.
Yeah, you get those mid-sized crossover types, you know.
Yeah, we rented one 1 year. It wasn't horrible, but yeah.
Right.
I'd be disappointed.
Are the drone operators all little, I say little, sorry, all younger people?
They happen to be on the team, more the younger ones, you know, and they go to the school for that. But, you know, the drones have a battery life of about 45 seconds. So by the time they get in the house, the guys are like, the battery's down. And I mean, it gives us a little bit of assistance. And we've had guys use anti-drone devices such as brooms. You know,
I'm like, I was thinking, you know, EW stuff or some electronic warfare, like jammers and stuff like that.
Oh, broom. No. Okay. Like a blanket.
A blanket, a broom, tennis racket.
Nice.
Maybe right. a pillow fight. Maybe with a drone.
Pillow. Yeah.
Does that work against those robot dogs with the machine guns on the back too?
We do not have those. We'd have like, we would have little critters that we'd like toss in the basement. I talked to my buddy the other day. I was like, hey, how's the operations been going? He goes, oh my gosh. Like the literal basement was just flooded with feces. And we had to go down and rescue the drones. And he says we were like taking buckets and like playing the floor as lava, except the floor was poop. And, you know, like trying to go through and like pick. And it's just, every bad story on SWAT is just poop because some people are disgusting. And so, you know, that's where the dogs go. Like, this is the room where the dogs go. I had a buddy who's like, he told me, like, I don't know where your life sinks to where one day you just decide we're going to start tooing in the toilet. Like, the toilet don't work, or tooing in the tub. He goes, the toilet don't work, so we're going to too in the tub now. And that's just the way it's going to be. Is like you've hit a low point.
You've hit something, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Sounds like you still talk to all your old teammates. It's kind of probably like a little brotherhood there.
Oh, it's very,
a lot of camaraderie, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
I mean, you got to depend on those guys to watch your back when you're working. So I'm sure that kind of transposes over to real life.
Not kind of, a lot. And it's not something where we all go, man, that was life and death. But they are actual life and death circumstances. Nobody's like afraid, but we're doing things where we could die, and then we get through it, and that bonds you together. Where like week after week, I'm doing stuff with these guys where we're surviving, we're going through it, and we did it because I supported you and you supported me. So absolutely, it bonds you.
Yeah. So. How far along are you on writing your book? Is it written now and you're doing back and forth?
Yep. Written and going through with a content editor and then copy editor. Right now, the FBI has it to make sure that I'm not going to embarrass them, which I won't. I embarrass me more than anyone. And so they got to get that back, and then it'll be typeset. So the book should be out in the fall. It is titled Irreverend. from Saving Souls to Chasing Sinners in the FBI.
Nice. Very cool.
So what have they asked you to take out of the book?
I'm just kidding with you. Look, it's one of those things where I'm like, what are you going to do if I leave that in? Like, you're going to sue me? And I also know that there's nothing in there, that there's nothing I'm sharing that's like inappropriate to like tradecraft or something. And everything else has already been adjudicated, so it'll be fine.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Lighten just up, FBI. Lighten up, FBI. Just
publish it.
I should. My publisher's a little sticky on that one, though. They want to get the okay.
Is this a one book deal? Is this going to be something you follow up with another book? Or are you unsure?
I still got a bunch of stories that I start putting down, like, oh, here's some other ones. So we'll see. I think the way I wrote it is kind of unique because I'm telling the story about coming from being a pastor into this. The stories themselves are pretty interesting too. But we'll see. I think there's other aspects that I can pass on in another book that I think I learned from the FBI about leading and following. So there could be others. I enjoy writing. So we'll see.
Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. All right. Well, I think we're at a point where it's a good place to start wrapping up. So first and foremost, where can people find you, follow you, find your work? And, you know, where do you plan on your book being released for consumption?
So you can follow me on Instagram at @Eric_Robinson. On LinkedIn with my name and this face, and I think you probably put FBI and you'll find me. And then my website where you can follow what I'm doing and when the book will be released is preachertobreacher.com. Yeah, you like that, huh?
That's a good one.
That's good.
That's
one.
Preacher to breacher.
Preacher to breacher.
There you go. All right. So we always like to give our guests an opportunity to give a shout out to someone that made an impact in their lives. And this can be a historical figure. It could be, you know, mom. It could be, you know, an old science teacher, whatever you want it to be. Who'd you like to give a shout out to?
We were just talking about him. So I got to see my SWAT teammates just yesterday because they've got their tryouts going right now. And so great to reconnect with them. My back hurts from getting slapped on it so many times with the hugs. So fantastic guys, the best, and one woman who I love too, the best SWAT team in the FBI. And I was glad to be a part of it. So Ben, our team leader, and the rest of the guys on the Cleveland FBI SWAT team, then shout out to them.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Alex, anything you want to wrap up with?
I think we got everything pretty covered. I don't know. I could probably come up with a million more questions if you got all night. I don't know.
Second go around. Let's do it. We'll schedule it for the next one.
I mean, the only thing I was thinking of is I don't know how old your kids are, but how did their friends take it when they come over and like, hey, what does your dad do? Does he sell cars or does he work at Walmart?
My kids are a disappointment to me in this realm. Everywhere else, not. They never told anybody. Like, they didn't want to tell people I was in the FBI. And there's a certain thing where you're like, hey, don't tell everybody. But like, I would have my youngest go, oh, I have to go to a White Elephant Christmas party. I got to get a gift. And I go, hey, I've got this FBI water bottle. She's like, why do I want that? I go, are you kidding? You don't think some 18-year-old, 17-year-old boy wouldn't want an FBI water bottle with an emblem on it? It's like, who would want that? I'm like, everyone? It's cool. And they were like, yeah, that's crazy. I mean, there's times I just like, you guys know, like, I'm the lead breacher for an FBI SWAT team. That's kind of cool. Like, that's a big deal. And like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Kids.
Yeah, they just don't really care.
What are you going to do? Kids are weird.
I definitely did not impress them, that's for sure.
Later on, they'll be impressed.
Pouring one out of my grave. Yeah, we're impressed with you, Pops.
No, I don't know how old your children are, but, you know, ours are in their 20s now.
Same here.
And, you know, it's starting to change some of that, you know.
There's a lot
more appreciation for, you know, the parental role at this point than there was in the teenage years.
Yeah.
So when you retired, did they give you like a gold watch or like a battering ram to take home? Or
whatever I could steal, I stole. My buddies in the SWAT team, so our outfits are, they're Cry Precision gear, and they're pretty expensive, like $300 for the shirts and stuff. And so I know how much that costs, and they got to save money. So with all the other gear I'm turning in, I turn that in, and my buddy Liz, who was working procurement for us, and folded it up nice, put it back on my seat, and said, nope, you keep that. So that was nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
It is nice.
Nice.
All right.
All right. I'm out of questions.
Okay. No, you're not. But we can have him back on another time. I'd be happy to do that. All right, everybody. First, thank you again for giving us some of your time. I really do appreciate it. And we would love to have you back on. All right, everybody, you know where you can find us. We're everywhere. We are now hosted also on fountain.fm. Go check us out. It's a value for value podcasting 2.0 hosting site. So if you feel like dropping a couple pennies our way, you can do that. No subscription or anything like that. And if you don't want to, then you don't have to. There's no pressure. What else did I want to say? Oh, yeah. Remember, wherever you are, whenever you're watching this, have an amazing day.
See you, everybody. Thanks for coming by, Eric.
Yep. Nice. Appreciate you guys.